Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 854. Hey, you know, we put sponsorships on the show, as you hear, if you listen to the intro. I know some of you skip through it. That's fine. But just so you know, it does keep the show free. It allows us to pay good folks like Katie Levine, who is working hard to produce your podcast. We always just want to make sure, when I started doing ads on the podcast several years ago now, I always wanted to make sure that they were relevant to your interests, so it didn't just seem like we were, you know, wasting your time with stuff that didn't make any sense to you. So help us continue to do that and bring relevant advertisers to us. Totally optional, but if you have a few minutes, go to podsurvey.com/nerdist. Take a quick anonymous survey that'll help us get to know you a little better. And then we can show advertisers exactly what it is that you want so we can bring you stuff that makes sense and keeps the podcast free. If not, no worries. And seriously, no worries if you skip through this anyway. Plus, once you've completed the survey, you can enter to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Again, that's podsurvey/nerdist, podsurvey.com/nerdist. Thanks for your help. And we hope we always do a good job of keeping all this stuff relevant and not wasting your time. Speaking of things that are relevant to you, let's go to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. events@nerdist.com is the email if you have something you want to submit. I want to thank Glass Goat for sending us an amazing stained glass piece of art. It's myself and Reggie Watts podcasting, and it says, "Enjoy your burrito." They make stained glass, drinking glasses, wine glasses, any kind of glass art, leather goods, much more. Go to glassgoat.com or just search Glass Goat on Etsy, and I will post the picture of that soon on Instagram, which I'm just at Hardwick. Also, Adam Beasley writes, "Hey guys and gal, I just wanted to share that after listening to Chris say quit doing stuff you hate and go out and do something you love, I finally listened, started a website, Lazy Guy DIY. I now teach people the woodworking with the power of pop culture, sarcasm, and dick jokes." Well done. Neil deGrasse Tyson really nailed it in your last interview with him when he said you don't need to be an expert to teach people. Just make it fun and relatable. I mean, unless, of course, you're like a physician. Maybe then be an expert before you teach people. But, you know, with crafts and things like this, absolutely. He always wears fun shirts in his videos, and he actually launched his own shirts to a company to raise money for his shop and his site. How can you say no to woodworking innuendo with a unicorn saying, "Something magical happens when I get wood"? They're on a limited run through February 19th. Go to bonfire.com/lazyguyDIY t-shirt. And thanks for listening, Adam, and congratulations on making your thing. By the way, I think on Lazy Guy DIY t-shirt, there's dashes in between every piece of those. So there you go. This episode is Lena Dunham, who I met at the Emmys a few years ago. It was so nice. And her boyfriend, Jack Antonoff, was on a few years back. And he was great, too. Actually, if you have some time after listening to this one, go back and listen to the Jack episode, too. Because it got real spiritual and, like, talking about anxiety and depression and all that sort of stuff. Unless you don't want to talk about those things. Hey, I'm not the branch manager of you. You can do whatever you want. So, Lena is promoting the final season of Girls this Sunday at 10 p.m. on HBO and, of course, on HBO Go and HBO Now. Also, listen to our podcast, Women of the Hour, which is available on iTunes and wherever podcasts are available, all over the vast expanse of Earth's internet. So here we go. This is the Nerdist Podcast number 854. Katie Levine, if you would be so kind, please roll the podcast thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Have you had green tea Kit Kats before?
I actually have eaten, like, maybe my weight in them, because I went to Japan and brought back, like, thousands.
That's what I did.
And I feel very grateful. Would you mind if I save this for myself first?
Save it for whenever you want. Whatever you want. Would anyone like a green tea Kit Kat?
Do you want one?
Because this is my favorite. I drink, like, 8 of these a day.
Oh, those are so good.
They're great, and green tea is my favorite substance. And when I went to Japan, I brought back so much green tea stuff.
Do you bring back bottles of green tea, or is there, like, a green tea powder that you can mix in?
I brought back all this green tea powder and, like, a tool, like a green tea mixing.
Oh, yes.
And, like, tons of this. And, like, they have, like, green tea Pepsi. Like, they've
got
such weird shit.
They know how to do it. They know how to
do
it right.
They do. Should I put this right here?
Yeah, put it right there.
I love the show. I'm really honored to be on.
Oh, Ma, thank you.
You're so great. And Judd Apatow says hi.
Tell him I said hello.
And I've been a fan of yours for many years.
Well, I appreciate that you say that, because when I met you at the Emmys a couple of...
I singled out Fandom.
Hey, you did! It was great! Because I, you know, that show feels like another lifetime to me. Like, it feels like... I mean, it was in the 1900s, you know?
It's like, it was the way that I felt about that show, like, I would cry if my mom, like, my mom knew, like, we couldn't make any stops on the way home from school, because it's like, if I wasn't home for Singled Out. Because what time was it on, like, 4 or something?
It was on, in its heyday, it was on, like, 4 times a day. There was, like, morning showings and afternoon, I think it was an evening show that they also aired at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Well, 4 o'clock was the time I was allowed to watch it.
Yeah.
And I was just obsessed.
The funniest thing to me about that show is that people will go... I'll meet people who are in their 20s, and I'll go, I watched that show when I was 9, but my mom didn't want me to. And I think back, I'm like, was the show really that rough? But I guess at the time,
it wasn't dirty. It was like Jenny would, like, say a sassy thing.
She would say a sassy thing, but we also had categories that were... like, pack it! You know, it's like we had a dong category on the game board, which, you know, in a period of time when they banned Baby Got Back.
How old were you when you were on that show? A child.
I was 12. I was 22.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
And then who replaced you and you left?
Jenny left and Carmen Electra replaced her.
But you never left.
I never left. The show just didn't last much longer after.
Because I just don't remember that much of Carmen's reign.
It was very short. They probably were about to... You know, like, 3 years was a good run on MTV at that time, because you would do hundreds of episodes.
Yeah.
And Jenny got all these other opportunities, so she went to do a sketch comedy show and a sitcom, and it kind of...
Fight vaccinations.
To fight, yeah. You know, all the stuff you do. And she left, and so the network kind of saw that as an opportunity to bring in to get some more attention around the show by bringing in Carmen. Yeah. But it lasted like a season and a half.
Carmen wasn't the comedian that Jenny was.
Well, Jenny had a natural aptitude towards silliness.
Yes.
That was just ingrained. Like, you can't teach someone to be silly.
No, you can't.
And she, you know, it was a really interesting thing at the time, because she really broke out of the mold of what people's expectations were of, like, oh, you're a playmate, so you are, you know.
Totally.
And she was making fart jokes and spitting at the
can. I thought she was so cool, and those candies ads she did when she was on the toilet.
Sitting on the can.
so much fun. Anyway, I was so into it, and it's a huge formative influence on my life, and I remember being like, I'll probably meet my husband on Singled Out.
No one ever...
That's not how I met my... No one ever got married from Singled Out.
I don't think anyone ever talked again from Singled Out. I've met people and I go, oh, they go, oh, I was on Singled Out. I go, do you ever... They go, no, I just wanted a snowboard, you know?
Yeah, like, totally. Well, you rule, and you've done so much great stuff since, and I love your nerdiness.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. And congratulations to you as well.
Thank you.
And that looks so cozy and fuzzy, what you're wearing right now.
Do you want a terrible trivia fact? It is so cozy, and it's literally was like... What set I took from my grandma's house when she died, because this was her, like, and she didn't die in it, but, like, she was wearing it, like, maybe, like, 20 minutes before.
Uh-huh.
And this was in, like, 1999. So this is from Gap, 1999.
And also has a history, has a family history at the same time.
It cozies me out so much.
But that, like, makes it so much nicer.
I'm glad you think so, because some people are like, way to bring your grandma's death polar fleece.
Oh, no, listen. My dad's dead. I talk about it in very casual terms all the time, because it's just a thing that happens.
It's just a thing that happens in life.
I mean, it sucks. I love them. Yeah. But it's a thing that happens.
And you got to keep the things of theirs that are meaningful to you.
But you know what's nice about that is that it doesn't just have physical coziness. It has emotional coziness, too.
So much emotional coziness. So I'm thrilled to be here. I know you have an out it, too.
And I know. I'm so sorry.
Don't be sorry.
We're live all week, and our schedule flipped.
I'm sorry because of the fact that I was a little bit late.
No, don't worry about it. You actually ended up not being late at all. Wouldn't that be funny if we just... I feel like this podcast would be a great Canadian podcast if we just apologized to each other the whole time.
Literally.
No, I'm sorry about the thing that you... No,
it's
I'm
my
sorry.
Number one. It's my number one move is just at long day all day long apologizing. These people can tell you. I'm a big apologizer.
I am too. And I wonder at what point... I often think about it. Like, is it... Because I feel like I'm always the first one going, no, I'm sorry. You... And I wonder if that is a good thing or if it's not a good... I can't decide if it's a good thing or not.
I think it depends. I think it's really good to have the skills to apologize when you're wrong. But I think that apologizing a lot when you're not wrong actually breeds, like, rage and resentment inside yourself and, like, eats away at your organs, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's probably true, because you think it's maybe a way to avoid conflict.
And what you're actually doing is apologizing, and then in your head you're like, but I'm not fucking sorry. I mean, that's my big experience, is like, I apologize when other people knock me over, that kind of thing.
What really head trips me sometimes is the idea of narcissism, because we use it very casually of like, oh, you know, I'm a comedian, I'm a narcissist, you know. I mean, obviously I'm self-focused because of what I do.
Yeah.
But then when you meet like a real clinical narcissist where someone really has zero ability to ever claim any responsibility for their actions.
Yeah, or empathize or connect.
Or connect with anyone else. And sometimes I head trip because I have a therapist and I go, what if I'm that and I don't know that? I would lack the skill to know that. And she was like, yeah, but you wouldn't ask that question. If
100%.
I go, but maybe I would. You know?
I know. Donald Trump's not sitting there being like, do you think I'm a clinical narcissist? He's like, I'm doing fine.
How am I coming off? Harsh?
Yeah, totally. Literally yesterday I was listening to him do that thing where he was like, all this is just a way to cover up Hillary Clinton's campaign mistakes. And I was like, it must be actually so fun to live in a brain where you can literally blame everything on everybody. Like, I don't know. Maybe it's actually pleasurable.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you would see it as having any value. I mean, if I were a clinical narcissist,
you've been really pleasant to me this entire time and asked me a bunch of questions about myself and expressed concern about my grandma's death from like 16 years ago. You're definitely not a clinical narcissist.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. I'm sure there's a variety of other flaws that we could cram together to make a little golf ball of emotional need. But I do feel that if you have that gene, you would never know that there's any kind of value on. I don't think it's fun or not fun. I think it's just, it's just kind of the way it
is. You work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to go back to this, but you brought it up again. I'm really curious about it. When your grandmother passed away, was it something that was expected, or was it something that was sudden?
Great question. I was incredibly close with my grandma. I was 13, about to be 14. She had been on dialysis for many years, but then had a sudden attack of peritonitis, like infection of her stomach lining, and was dead in like 2 days.
Oh,
so,
my God.
And it was my first experience with like somebody that you have, you know, I'd had like family members die who you see once every 6 months. But this was like sort of my person. I was a kid who had no friends and I would talk on the phone with my grandma for like an hour a day.
Right.
And we would also write each other letters almost every day, even though she lived about an hour and a half from me. Like we had an incredibly involved relationship. So that was actually like whenever anyone's like, why can you never chill out? Why do you work so hard? Why do you feel like you're like, you know, that line from Hamilton, like, why do you write like you're running out of time? I'm like, because my grandma died. Like, literally, I can trace every ounce I have of, like, productivity anxiety. But I remember literally thinking after my grandma died, like, well, I'm never just going to spend a whole afternoon watching TV again. Like,
right. People
just die. It happens.
Wow. And to hit you, I mean, you could not be in your more formative years than, like, 13 to 14.
oh my God. And also, I don't know if you feel this way, but and you said your father passed away. I'm so sorry. But seeing a dad cry to me is like the saddest thing that can happen.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah, I hear what you're saying. My dad was a baller. Like my dad was a baller. He was a baller and let he cry. Like my dad, and he was sort of a classic dude. You know, he just came from that era. He was born in 1941. He was just like a dude. But very sensitive.
Yeah.
And he could watch, like, if he was watching an insurance commercial and a dog ran up, he would start crying. You know, it's like he was one of those.
Totally.
You'd be in a movie with him that was, I mean, there are some sad movies, but there are some movies where, you know, it's like you would just hear, and you're like, really? This one? You know?
That's
if there
amazing.
Was a particularly emotional CSI, he'd be like, oh.
That's amazing. So, well, my dad is not a crier. My dad is like a very articulate about his feelings, but in a very kind of stoic, waspy way. And so I remember not only being so upset about my grandmother, but having the experience of seeing my dad cry and being like, literally nothing is as I thought it was.
Oh, right.
I remember sitting and watching my dad cry, and literally he was like, a science experiment to me. Like, I was like, there's water coming out of my dad's eyes. Like,
was that it and it never happened again?
I think I've seen my dad cried when he dropped me off at college.
Oh,
so that's so cute.
Come
and sad.
On, that's adorable.
It was adorable. He cried, and I remember I was walking into my dorm and I looked back and he was like trying to hide it. And I was like, this is like, it haunted me basically for the rest of my years. My dad crying as I walked into my dorm.
God, I wonder. I think about having kids sometimes, and I wonder if I will be emotional in front of them about things, where's the line between, like, you need to let them know that it's okay to have an emotional experience, but you also want them to know, you kind of need to lie to your kids to some extent to make them feel safe.
100%.
I always say,
when I have kids, I really want to make sure that they know that, like, they can't, like, I think the worst thing you can do as a parent is, like, make your kids feel like they have too much power, like the power to hurt your feelings or the power. Like, I like the fact that my parents are always like, yeah, we respect you a lot, but you have no actual input over our actions and you're not capable of hurting our feelings or truly upsetting us. Like, I feel like the most fucked up parent-child relationships I know are when a kid's been, like, given the emotional power of an adult over their parents.
Oh, my God. Yeah, those are the kids that are on, like, the Maury Povich show where they're knocking over chairs and she's like, don't do that, Chandler. He's like, fuck you, bitch. Yeah. And the audience is like, oh. And she's like, I don't know how to stop, you know.
And I'm so hurt. I'm so hurt.
But I do think that it's important to – because – listen, I remember being a kid, and I remember being kind of an opportunistic little prick.
Me too.
You're testing boundaries because you're practicing life.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's important to figure out. But you know, I have no idea how to go about doing that. Parenting is complex.
I'm literally have such a complicated relationship with just like parenting my dogs. The other day, somebody told me like they were like, you need to be firmer with them because I have two like little girl poodles who are not like great with their housebreaking. Someone was like, you got to be firmer with them. And so then I saw one of my poodles like do what I thought was like about to pee in the house. And I was like, Susan, no, no, Susan, no. And then I looked and she was literally just sitting. And I was like, the one time I chose to yell at you and you're not fucking doing anything.
So now Susan's going to go back to the other dog and go, it's not okay to sit anymore. I don't know what happened. What? Something
now
changed.
We just have to stand for the rest of time.
I don't know what to believe in.
No, I'm such a, like, I have so much dog mom guilt.
What's your other dog's name?
Karen.
Love it. I had a dog named Scott. It's the best.
Scott is a great dog name.
People names for dogs are the fucking best.
And, like, not even just people names, like people names that are, like, the name of a person you'd meet who worked in, like Allison Williams from my show calls them Karen and Susan in accounting. Like, she's always like, could you please pass this message to Karen and Susan in accounting? And then our other dog who has emotional problems and has to, he's had some issues and has to live in a special naughty dog home.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Lammy, which is not, and my dad was like, you should have called him Keith. You didn't set him up for success.
You gave him, that's right.
Yeah.
You gave him the name that he was going to rebel against.
Yeah. You can't have a sweet, soft Lammy. Like, they're going to rage if you name them after a stuffed toy.
He's going to shave off his arm hair and tattoos and doggy nose rings.
Literally, he was so like, he had such a like American History X vibe. He was really a lot to handle.
But you gotta love him anyway because he's your pet.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I have necklaces with the images of all. I don't know how I will love a child more than I love these dogs.
My mom's super maternal with the dogs, and she has one dog, and she'll have a dog for a long time, and then it'll pass away, And then it takes, she never gets over it. I'm not going to do this again. I can't do this again. Then a year will go by. Wow. I mean, a friend of mine had this, I'm just going to foster it for a little. And then within a week, it's like,
she's got a dog and it's
she has a dog. She's pushing it in a stroller. I mean, it's just, you know.
100%. I used to have a rabbit I walked on a leash. Like, there's no boundaries to
me. How do you do that?
I had a rabbit in high school that I straight up, like, I watched a tutorial online and, like, learned to harness and walk my rabbit. And I would walk it around Brooklyn Heights. It had its injections and I would just walk, I'd bring it to school, like, I was like I was a weird rabbit freak.
Wow. I feel like the next thing you write should be called Harness Your Rabbit.
Harness it means. I don't know if Harness Your Rabbit is like sexual, if it's about the power to do good work. I don't know what Harness Your Rabbit is about.
I'll tell you what it is. Harness Your Rabbit is about finding a way to bring a dissonant structure to something.
Yeah.
Because a rabbit should probably not be walked on a leash.
Ever.
But it's something that you figured out.
How to do.
You figured out how to do it.
What's the weirdest pet you've ever had?
Well, I tried for a spell when I was a kid to raise hamsters.
Mm-hmm.
That was about probably the weirdest pet. And I was never able to, boy, I had so many failures trying to get them, you know, they would breed and then she would give birth and then
she would eat the babies.
She would eat. Well, yeah, the first time the pet store guy goes, well, you got to take the male out as soon as she gives birth or she'll kill him.
Yeah.
Because she's protecting. I go, okay. They're monsters. I get it. They're tiny monsters.
Yeah.
So we pulled them out, and like 2 days later, they were all dead, and we realized we had pulled out the female.
No!
But he went over and sat. Like, he was very maternal with them.
So you couldn't tell.
We didn't know. And so then we put her, we were like, okay, so we put her back in. Immediately she ran over and just devoured. I mean, it was the most monstrous thing to see as a child.
It's hell. It's actual hell.
Never actually succeeded.
My biggest fantasy is to find a dog, like, is, like, to have a dog wander into my yard who just, like, happens to have puppies. Like, I want so bad. There's no good reason to breed your dog. It's, we all know, like, there's too many dogs on the planet. But if a dog accidentally came
sure,
to my house.
Your fault.
No.
You're saving them.
Do you know what a sugar glider is?
Yeah, yes. Sugar gliders are fucking awesome.
I want one so bad. And my boyfriend's like, we cannot have, you need to build, like, an entire structure for them. But they're, like, these big-eyed flying squirrel marsupials. They're the only marsupial you can legally keep as a pet.
Are they legal in California, or you don't live in California?
Well, I live between New York and California. They are legal in California. They're not legal in New York.
Interesting.
And, I mean, it seems like a lot of, you carry it in, like, a polar fleece pocket around your neck.
That's so sweet.
Because they need to feel safe all the time. Like, I also am really into fennec foxes.
I was just about to say, I dated a girl who was convinced we should get a fennec fox. And I was like, they're wild animals. You can't, like, every video we saw of someone having a fennec fox in their house was the fucking fox running 360 degrees.
Around the house and shitting on everything and, like, eating
everything.
Well, there's a new craze in Brooklyn, where I live most of the time, which is, like, hipsters have been, like, raising baby squirrels that they find fallen out of the nest. Because for some reason, and I don't get the correlation, like, something having to do with, like, global warming and unseasonable warmth means that, like, a lot more baby squirrels are, like, dropping out of their nests at random times.
Sure.
I don't know the science behind it. So I know this, like, cool hipster guy who raises little squirrels he finds, like, on the ground in Brooklyn. And then another friend of mine tried to do it and then figured out it was a rat. She was like, I'm raising the cutest squirrel. And she got in touch with me and she was like, where do I drop it off? And then she took the squirrel to, like, I have a friend who's an animal rehabilitator, and my friend Elizabeth was like, bring her to this place. They'll help you figure it out. And they were like, this is a straight up rat. And the minute, and they have no loyalty, and it will fucking, the minute it can, like, bite your hand off. Because, like, a city rat?
Yeah.
Is there anything more evil than, like, a New York subway rat?
They don't have time for your bullshit, the city rats.
No.
They don't. They just need to breed and eat as much as possible, and sometimes that means you. I don't know how you confuse a squirrel with a rat.
Well, I guess when they're babies, they look a lot alike, but then they were like, you know, this has, like, a long rat tail. And I have to admit, the girl who found it is, like, kind of a stoner. Like, I think she was just like, cute squirrel. And I was like the worst. I couldn't believe it. And I was somehow got very involved with, like, trying to find the right, because she was going on vacation and she needed someone to take care of the squirrel. So I, like, got a wildlife rehabilitator involved. I got super emotionally invested and they were like, shit, man, it's a rat.
That is a straight up rat.
Yeah.
And did she let it go at that point? What do you do?
They put it down.
Oh.
They gave it, like, a lethal injection because they were like, you're going to raise it and then it's going to cause destruction.
So this rehabilitator was the one that
was like, you can't keep this thing alive.
Oh, wow.
So we had a story on my podcast. This girl shared a story on the Cats episode of Women of the Hour about, I don't know if you ever heard the story about the woman in LA who put up a sign that said, like, kitten found, is this yours? Kind of smelly, pretty nice, with a picture of a skunk, and then like put her phone number on it, and she just wanted to see what people would do.
Yeah.
And she's got like thousands of voicemails ranging from people really kindly informing her it was a skunk to being like,
she got some fucking
what the fuck
vitriol.
Is wrong with you, you dumb piece of shit, that's a skunk.
Yeah.
And like, excuse me, ma'am, but I think what you may have found is a skunk. And her story is like beautiful, and it came from her being really lonely in LA and being like, I need to do something that like brings me together with other people, and her idea. And so we had an entire Cats themed episode of Women of the Hour, and her skunk story was the piece de resistance.
And that didn't disenchant her in any way about how negative and vitriolic people can
she
be?
Said it made her feel like more than like there were gross vitriolic messages, but more were people who genuinely wanted to let her know with kindness and love that she was raising a skunk. And like, can I help you please to get rid of the skunk or to save the skunk? And she said like, there was also just something about like knowing that people were looking at her sign and responding that like made the world
feel smaller.
Feel
connected.
Yeah, and she said that she's like now the flyer's all over the internet, and so she'll still get calls sometimes like 10 years later, and she can't bring herself to change her phone number.
That's really amazing.
It's kind of a beautiful story.
Yeah, it's when people feel like they have some type of high ground, whether it's moral or academic or whatever, they really make no bones about just flying into – it's like, oh, now I can unleash all the rage.
Have you ever noticed how psyched people are when you have a typo on Twitter? People fucking love to point out a typo. And you're like, excuse me.
Hate to be that person. No, you don't.
Yeah, you love to be that person.
You love to be that person.
But then I've also – my boyfriend pointed out, which was really right, that like every time he gets a negative comment on Twitter, they've confused – like there and there, like they've always done some horrible grammar. Like no one comes at him with good grammar.
With good grammar, yeah. I feel like I do get that a lot. Or boy, this really pissed someone off. At midnight, I improperly used the phrase "begs the question," which does not mean raises the question. And so, but I said,
what does it mean?
I don't know. I'm dumb. But I said, you know, something begs a question. And this guy, I mean, and it got to the point where he was just straight up like, fuck you, you know. Like, I was like, and so that made me kind of want to engage a little bit and be like, well, you seem very upset about this. It was, you know. It was, you know, how many productions do you have going at once that you might make a mistake?
Such as you. Plus, I also really thought begs the question meant raises the question.
It does not mean raises the question. Katie, would you like to look it up?
Yeah. I'm upset now.
Begs versus raises the question. But he was very, very, very upset. And this obviously was a thorn in his craw that has been festering over many, many, many years.
It used to mean that someone has made a conclusion based on a premise that lacks support.
Right, which is not the same as raises the question.
So I guess it means like I could say like Donald Trump says that we had no contact with Russia, which begs the question, what the fuck is going on?
And but then I think he would say that's wrong because you're saying that raises the I think they're not interchangeable. I think you can't interchange begs and maybe that guy was wrong, but I have a feeling people are going to let us know at this point.
Yeah, so I hope that they reach out and let us know. There's a few things like that, like, you know, like what's the one that we always think means for a moment, but means in a moment.
I don't know. What?
There's a word that like everybody thinks means for a moment. It's like, this drives me insane and now I'm going to forget what it is. I'm ruining your whole podcast.
No, you're not ruining it. You can't ruin this podcast.
But that's such great news. But it's like, not momentarily, but now I'm going to forget what it is. But I remember I misused it once to mean for a moment when it means in a moment.
Sure.
And then that begs the question, who the fuck cares?
Well, for some people who are – it's just amazing to me what people will zero in on. And I think it's hard sometimes not to personalize things and go, wow, I feel like – I'm sorry. You know, especially when you are empathetic to other people's feelings and you don't want people to be upset. But at a certain point, you have to go, well, you know, the level of rage that that person's experiencing, there's maybe there's more going on, and I should just let that person
have their experience. Fly away.
Let them have their feelings and don't try to control their feelings, and they can be mad, you know, and it's not about me. You know, 100%. I made a mistake, but
I had, did you have grammar, like grammar Nazi parents? Like I had a very aggressive grammar dad.
No. My dad's grammar was okay, decent. My dad was born in Alabama and, you know, raised in the streets of San Francisco in the 1940s and 50s.
So he was, you know,
my dad was street smart. My dad was very smart. But he was not. He was a smart guy. But he was just not a very academic guy. Well, my mom was academic.
Whatever the opposite of street smart is. My dad literally once was like on. This makes me. Once he was on the train and just like a group of teenage girls like started screaming at him and he just like couldn't even like just like telling him how like lame he looked and he like couldn't even respond.
Oh, that's a bummer.
But he's really cool. He's just not like cool like that.
Right.
But he would like if. If I said like me and my friend,
right?
I was practically grounded. Yes, like there was no, or even if I said like my friend and me, he'd be like, well, we wouldn't say me is going to the store. You'd say I am going to this. Like it was so beaten into us,
right?
And still to this day, he'll correct my grammar in public in front of people, and I'm like, I'm a 30-year-old professional woman. This doesn't feel good.
Well, I think obviously it probably. You know, there are much deeper implications for stuff like that because I think we all have things that we, you know, get obsessive over.
Yeah.
And they, to the outside world, like, why would you care? And I think a lot of it is just, especially now, the everything feels so uncontrollable that we focus in on minutiae because we're just trying to, it's like, I can control this thing.
Yeah.
So just don't violate this one rule because I need something to hold the fabric of this fucking universe together.
I know. And I have obsessive compulsive disorder, so I relate deeply to needing things to hold the fabric of your universe together. I just try to do ones that don't force other people to, like mine are all self-directed. Like I try not to force other people to engage my obsessive habits.
Right. And is that, I assume when you say you're a boyfriend, you mean Jack?
Yes.
Great guy.
He's great and he loves you.
You know, he was so great on the podcast a couple years ago.
He loves you.
Such a sweet guy.
And he listens to your podcast too. And he doesn't listen to my podcast. But he does listen to yours.
Have you had this discussion before? Are you like, you don't have to listen to it?
It's interesting. He'll be like, I've listened to every episode. And I'll be like, say what happened on the last episode. He'll be like, I don't have to prove myself to you. But he makes jokes about it. Like the podcast is like about feminist issues. It's called Women of the Hour. And he will make jokes. He'll be like, today's episode of Women of the Hour, one woman uses a very specific kind of flute. Like he thinks it's like just – he's like, what is this about? And I'm like, there's actually really interesting stories in there if you just open your ears. He'll listen if I'm like, will you listen to this edit and tell me what you think? But I have to be like there forcing him.
Sure.
It was funny. For a long time, he had my book in his suitcase. And I'd be like, why are you carrying my book? And he's like, just makes me feel good to have it with me. And I'm like, so romantic. Then I was like – oh, because you haven't read it.
He's getting to it.
You're carrying it everywhere in an attempt to read it.
He's getting to it.
He knows what's in there, but he loves your podcast.
Oh, that's so sweet. He was really great when he came on, and it was such a it took this really great turn into, you know, just like the brain stuff that we all have. And
he's very one of the things I really like about him is he's very open to talking about his own anxiety and discomfort in a way that I think is comforting to other people.
100%.
And a lot of like, you know, like being like a rock musician, like it's not a culture that really encourages you to like be vulnerable, maybe more than it used to. But like he definitely doesn't feel the need to like play the cool dude, which I like.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, I love talking about that stuff on here, and I love talking about sobriety, which I'm sure, and you know, dealing with mental health issues because I do feel like even though some people if this irritates you, you're lucky, which means you're probably not suffering from it. But I do feel like it's healthy. It helps when people hear people talk about it in very calm terms, like you talk about your grandmother, I talk about my dad, then I think it just demystifies some of the scariness of it.
How long have you been sober?
Oh wow, almost. This is 14 years.
That's amazing. That's like a real accomplishment. Congratulations.
I guess. Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, I think it doesn't feel like an accomplishment in the sense that I don't think, hey, look what I did. I just sort of feel like, well, there are two paths, and this path led to this lifestyle, and I wanted this one.
Yeah.
And so I just, I did this one, and I'm glad I did. I never regretted it.
Do you, are you, forgive me for not, are you like a program person, or are you?
No, but what's interesting is that I just, or maybe not interesting, but I just went to, when I first got sober, I went to a couple meetings, and I didn't like them.
Yeah. My dad had the same thing. He was like, I'm going to do this by myself.
I went to meetings where it just sort of, I had a struggle with the God stuff, and I had a struggle with being told, like, well, you need to do it this way or it's not going to work.
Yeah.
Which I had since been told, like, well, that was a very strict interpretation of, you know, I was told, though, well, you went to bad meetings. And I go, okay, but those are the ones I went to. So I had a therapist, and I had some other comic friends who were a support. I had a support structure.
Which is what you need. Which is the basis structure of AA is a support structure.
Yes. That one didn't work for me, but I've never poo-pooed it for anyone that it works for. I feel like whatever. But a friend of mine just called me recently and said, hey, I'm going to this one meeting, and there's this really great speaker. Would you come? And I go, yeah, I would love to. I'm curious to see what. And I really loved it. And what it reminded me is that the most important thing that any of us can really fall back on is community. There was a community of people there. Well, and that part was very nice for me.
Well, I have this. I go to Al-Anon. I don't go. I had a year where I was going very religiously. And then I found some other things that I felt were helping me with the same issues. So I stopped going as much. But I have to say that even though I really loved what Al-Anon was talking about, I also had a lot of issues with the God and higher power stuff. It was hard for me to – because even if they say, like, God as you see him or her, it's still a term that has so much stigma around it for me for whatever reason that it was just – it was tough. And that same thing of, like, you know, anything that has too many mantras or too many – sets of rules is, I think when you're you and I probably share, like, I think a lot of people who are creative and a lot of people who are comics have a little bit of an authority problem. And
sure.
It's hard to carry your authority problem into a 12-step meeting.
Well, yeah. And I think that is, you know, any of these issues, whether it's, and I almost kind of feel like alcoholism is a bad label in the sense that it really is kind of an obsessive issue, I think. And alcoholism is a symptom of that. Like, that's a thing that people go to the same way that they would go to obsessive sex or workaholism or upset or anything.
And I know a lot of people whose addictions have traveled, who's like, who have,
oh,
like,
of course,
they've gotten sober, but like they work out like a fiend and they can't stop sleeping with models or whatever it is. And
oh, I notice that stuff all the time in myself. And I recognize, like, okay, my brain has an obsessive quality to it.
Totally.
Because I need to, you know, I like ups and downs, and it's very hard for me to stay still. But but very recently, the God stuff, and we talked about it a lot with Pete Holmes, too, when he was on the podcast, but the God stuff for me.
He likes God stuff.
He likes God stuff. And he explained it in a really lovely way that was very meaningful to him. And you know, I mean, I have no qualms with it at all. I just don't. For me, it's just I was raised Catholic. I went to Catholic school.
Yeah.
So it's very hard for me to wrap my brain around that part of it.
Well, it's interesting. One of my really close friends is the author Mary Carr, who's an amazing writer. And she's written a lot about her sobriety. And she's written three memoirs, Liar's Club, Cherry, and Lit. And they're incredible books. And they're about her experience of growing up in a dysfunctional Southern home and then becoming a drug addict and then recovering. And she's also became extremely Catholic in her adulthood. But she's also part of, like, the world of the New York literati, which isn't a place where religion is. I mean, she said to me, she was like, she told me in an interview that I did with her, she was like, saying you're Christian in, like, the New York literary world is kind of, like, probably what it feels like to say that, like, you're a Republican and at a certain kind of party. Like, just, it's not a great feeling. She's like, but despite it all, she's like, I just feel like it makes me. She explained it to me really gently. She's like, whatever holds you accountable and makes you feel like a better, stronger person is where you should head.
Yeah.
And for me, that's, I mean, my house is full of crystals and I do a lot of yoga, so I don't see where the distinction really is, but the God stuff for me, it's hard for me to separate it from all of, like, the violence that I feel like it's perpetuated.
Well, I think it you know, it's a lot of it is a reflection of whatever baggage you have, you know, and for some of it for me, it was just very hard to, because I love science so much. And I'm always fascinated by people who can be scientists and also religious at the same time. Yeah. And that's not a disparaging comment at all. I legitimately,
no, it's a fascinating thing.
It is like, oh, wow, how do you, you know, what you can see and what you can't see and what you can prove and what you can't prove. And but with the AA stuff, what I came to really understand for myself was that the God stuff is really about me always needing to be in control and just letting go of that control.
Yeah.
And that doesn't have to mean like it's a guy on a cloud with a beard and yeah. he's barefoot, you know. he's walking around in the cloud. Like yeah. it doesn't have to mean that. It's really just about the higher power stuff again, which dances near the God border, I think, in some people's minds. But I was like, oh, it just means you got to let go that you can't control anything. And that's very hard for people like us.
That's the thing. The reason I went to Al-Anon is because I'm like totally codependent and have a belief at some in some essential part of myself that I can cure the people around me who are suffering and or control our relationships. And I mean, my obsessive need to have all of my relationships be quote unquote as healthy as they could be was actually leading to like some kind of toxicity.
Right.
And I think what they're trying to say to you with the higher power stuff when you go to Al-Anon is like, bitch, you're not controlling shit.
Right, right.
Someone else or nobody's in control, but it's not you.
Right.
And I remember like really sit, and it was comforting to just sit around with people who had realized that a long time ago.
Yeah.
And seemed like, and then I came home and I was like, Mom, I liked Al-Anon, but I hated everyone's shoes. I was like, and she was like, that's not a good reason not to return.
But that's what your brain focused on.
And it is. And it's funny because my mom once stopped seeing a therapist because she didn't like his snow boots. So clearly there's something hereditary happening here with self-help and footwear.
Yes, but I also think that, you know, something happens in our brains where we're trying to understand the world. We're trying to parse out all the information that we're getting. And now it's just so much information. It's just too much information.
Too much information.
And so, you know, I think in order to sort information, I don't think our brains are evolved enough to sort through all this information. And so we need shortcuts, and we need, you know, when there's a gap between what we perceive as reality and what our expectations are, we have to bridge that gap somehow. Yeah. And a lot of times, you know, that's where shortcutting happens, or that's where like, well, I didn't like those shoes, or like, oh, I didn't like that guy's fate. You know, it's just like we need reasons for things so that our information can be sorted and processed.
Well, I was obsessed. Did you watch Leah Remini's Scientology show?
No, but I've heard it's amazing.
It's the greatest thing in my life. Like, I feel as though I would not have lived through the first 3 months of a Trump presidency without like doing something fucking insane. Like, I would have had an insane public breakdown moment if it weren't for Leah Remini's show. And something about Leah Remini's just like, there's something really moving about the fact that she's like, I'm not going to go quietly into that good night. She was like, this took 30 years of my life that I'm not going to get back. And so I'm going to do everything I can to expose and explain and understand what's happened to me. And so in that way, there's like a really beautiful like pathos and emotionality to like her journey.
Sure.
So it's easy to just look at it as like, this is a weird reality show about Scientology. But I actually believe like it's an example of like how people take their trauma and rejigger it. Because Leah Remini's whole thing is like, if I can get one person to not – to leave Scientology or to understand the problematic nature of what's happening here, if I can get one family back together, like she's sort of like Mother Teresa-ing it all across America with a lot of makeup on, and I respect that lady. But I was also interested. I was like, it's an like the amount, the fact that Scientology has become a $1 billion industry is just evidence of how badly people need to have the world managed for them.
Well, everyone needs something. I think everyone needs something, and it does, you know, like whether it's, you know, and I'm very much like, you know, I mean, I see in the subculture that I'm in, people, you know, maybe that's Firefly, or maybe that's maybe that's collectibles, or I mean, you know, whatever it is that you need to align yourself with so that you can, you know, kind of build out a little igloo of safety, you know,
so
and where you feel safe and familiar.
One of the reasons Jack and I connected so much when we first met is we were both, and I'm sure you were like this too, we were kids who had a lot of collections and we like still have our collections.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
And a lot of Jack's collections are in our house, whether it's his Star Wars toys or whether it's his like, you know, old copies of George and Spy magazine, mm-hmm. or whether, I mean, I had an Archie collection, I had an X Factor collection, I had a doll, Madame Alexander doll collection, and like that was how I understood the world as a kid, was like, if I can manage and perfect my collection, and I didn't have a lot of friends, so I would come home from school every day and like put my comics in and out of their sleeves,
good,
move my Madame Alexander dolls on their stands, make sure that everything looked, I was really into like laying it all out as if an audience was going to come into my room to like observe my museum,
yes,
which it wasn't. Even now, like, my hobbies are beading and, like, to relax myself, I bead and I also draw. Like, not well. They're just things I, like, you need to do something that's not your work. And I spend as much time organizing my beads into little compartments and organizing my Sharpies, my colored Sharpies, as I do actually doing the activities.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's all – but that's part of the experience. You know, it's all part, yeah, of the experience. For people with cosplay, it's not just putting on the costumes. It's acquiring the – things to make the costumes and the experience, God, and the level of detail and the...
My mom's an artist and she takes a lot of pictures. She's really into like Japanese cosplay subculture. And so my mom takes a lot of pictures of these things called Kigurumi masks.
I know Kigurumi, yeah.
So yeah, so my mom has like 10 Kigurumi masks. They scare the shit out of me. She also has like 5 of those Japanese, very ornate Japanese sex dolls, the silicone, mm-hmm, sex dolls.
Yep.
And all the accessories that go with them. And I mean, going to my mom's studio is remarkable because it's like she the amount of items that it takes to create the amount of items that it takes to make the image work, whether it's like put, you know, the various latex items that go under the Kigurumi head or the 3 wigs she has for her sex doll, like, there's, you know, we're all working it out that way.
By the way, your parents sound like a late 90s Ben Stiller movie plot.
I mean,
he's all likes reading books and she throws paint on things. Like, it.
They're really weird. I have to say, they live in this house in Connecticut. They're from New York. I mean, they've lived in New York since the 70s, but like 6 years ago, they bought an old schoolhouse in Connecticut.
And oh, that sounds awesome.
It's pretty awesome. It's in the middle of town. So like, they're kind of the freaks in the middle of town and they each have studios in the house. And my dad is a painter and my mom is a photographer and a lot of her work centers around dolls and toys. So like, my mom's, you could mistake my mom's studio for like a, you could mistake my mom's studio for like a weird Japanese toy store.
Sure.
And you could mistake my dad's studio for like where the Unabomber lives.
Sure.
And they're just like doing their damn thing up there. And then they just like take breaks to watch BBC and then go back to their studios.
Wow.
It seems really fun.
Do you think you know what, man, this might be reaching. This might be reaching.
Reach.
So as I'm talking to you more and starting to contextualize things, I sort of think, because you're 30 now, right?
I am.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. 30s. I saw it on a medical form the other day. Like, it said like 30 years old. And I was like, who's 30 years old? And I was like, oh, me.
Yeah, you.
Me. Weird.
Yeah, you get used to it. I thought I freaked out before I turned 40, but no.
No, you look, and you look great.
Hey, come on.
I told Jack the other day that he was turning, like, he'd forgotten that he was turning 33. And I was like, you're turning 33. And he's like, no, I'm turning 32. And I was like, oh, you're turning 33.
I forget how old I am all the time. And then I remember, and I'm like, oh, it's sort of like that moment when you wake up in the morning where you forget everything and then,
yep,
you remember everything and you're like, oh.
Oh, and you're either really thrilled to wake up from a dream or you're really bummed. Like, you're, yeah, like, my life is so great. Or you're like, my life's not as great as that dream was.
Yeah, something weird happened the night before and you'd forgotten about it. And then you wake up, oh, I still got to, yeah, deal with that thing. That's what it feels like to be my age. But so your grandmother dies when you're 13.
Mm-hmm.
10 years later, at 23, your anonymity kind of dies.
Yeah.
And these are both very formative because, you know, 13, 14 is very formative as you begin to become an adult with an identity. But I feel like there's the secondary one that happens when you're like 22 or 23 and you spend your 20s kind of solidifying whatever is really going to be the core of this, like, probably lifelong, yeah, identity of whoever you are. And so you do that, you know, publicly. You become kind of famous at 23 and you make this thing and which is incredible that, you know, I mean, I was hosting a show.
You were singled out and I was obsessed with you.
I didn't write it and direct it and produce it. And
you had to do a lot of improv and don't pretend you didn't.
All right.
Don't pretend that's not an accomplishment.
Dong sizes.
Although you may have just like really explained some stuff to me because I kind of feel in some ways like I'm always – I feel like the period between when I was 13 and 20 – 13 is when I was really like, I want to be an artist and a creator, and 23 is when I stopped getting to have that sort of magical feeling of just being alone in your house, working on something that you don't know if anyone will ever see, and you're working on it just for like the love of the game.
Right.
So I spend a lot of time thinking and remember, like my experience of being alone in my high school bedroom will always sort of be like the safe space I'm trying to get back to.
Right.
If that makes sense.
And, sure.
And I feel as though I've been realizing lately how things about, you'd think like, oh, the show came on the air and it really like, I was forced to mature really quickly. But there is something about like fame and success that a little bit traps your identity in amber. And now that the show is ending, I'm sort of being forced to like examine all the things that I didn't address during that period of time.
Sure.
And my busyness and my sort of, and you know, public speculation about my life, et cetera. There were lots of excuses for me not to just sort of look at myself.
Mm-hmm.
And starting to look at yourself again is both really interesting and really unfun all at the same time.
It is unfun, but you know, the long game on that is that, you know, you experience the most amounts of growth from the highest periods of discomfort.
Yeah.
So it feels good. And I definitely feel like as a culture, we lean on, like, we seek comfort as much as possible, yeah. Like really to an unhealthy degree.
Well, sometimes don't you feel like self-help is sometimes like actually just people looking for a book to say like, you're doing great just as you are? Like self-help, people don't actually want to do the work. What they want is confirmation sure. that they've already done the work.
And yeah, in some cases I agree with that. I do, because when I got sober, I absorbed every self-help, everything. Because I'm like, well, I need to figure out, like, I need to get better.
Who I am and what I'm doing.
And what you find is that a lot of it's repetitive.
Yeah.
Which makes you think, well, either some of these people were lazy or there are some things that are just universally true about this stuff and they're borrowing from each other or whatever. But you know, it sucks to end. I'm sure it's scary to end something, you know, yeah. That's been so much a part of your, I mean, 23 to 30 is such a formative time. And I think people don't really realize that, but you're that's a whole separate identity that's forming. And then you had to do it publicly.
It's a wild thing. And I think I think something that was weird was like, I keep mentioning this, but this podcast is called Nerdist, which is like, I wasn't a very popular kid and it wasn't other kids' fault. I just like, it's not like I was victimized in my suburban school. Like I went to a cool school in New York. I could have had friends, but I just, for whatever reason, didn't have the skill set or the interest. I had a lot of fear around it. So kind of just as I started to be a social person, I also became very visible.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I'm still figuring out how to have reciprocal adult relationships, particularly with other women. But it's funny because I've spent like all this time making a show about it, so I should be some kind of expert, and it turns out I'm the opposite of an expert.
Does it get under your skin when you feel, if you ever feel misunderstood, particularly in a culture where if someone hears a snippet of something or if they see something and they go, oh, well, you know, fuck that person. And you're like, but you didn't even really investigate the – how
that's
do you –
That's the hardest thing to me. I mean, I'm sure you feel it too. But to me, the worst feeling in the world is when it feels like you're being willfully misunderstood, because I don't mind making a mistake and I don't mind being corrected. But I do mind being chastised by like a world that doesn't want to – hear the totality of your thought. And specifically, if you're like a loud woman, they're always looking for an excuse to just kind of like, I feel like all of my friends who are female public figures experience this, which is like everyone is looking for an excuse, even other women sometimes, because of the internalized misogyny that we all have, sure, to just like slap you the fuck down. And I think what's painful is when it's like when you're like a little kid and your parents send you to your room and you're like, but I didn't get to explain. And it's like, I feel that way about the internet a lot. I'm like, I didn't do what you thought I did. Like, I remember once in high school, my friend Josephine, she won't mind. She's an adult. She's married now. She was on the phone with her boyfriend in the middle of the night. And her parents came in and were like, what are you doing? It's 4 a.m. You can't be on the phone. And she was like, I'm on with Lena. And I had my own phone line. And so our parents were friends. So they called and they were like, Lena and Josephine have been on the phone every night at 4 a.m. And my parents took away my phone line. And I was like, it wasn't me. And I literally am like, feel that way all the time. And like, it took me like 4 days to be like, she was talking to her boyfriend. She lied. And so now I like get this like hot kid-like rage that I associate with either not getting what you want in a toy store or Josephine getting my phone line taken away.
It wasn't me. I love that.
It wasn't me.
Do you watch Twilight Zone at all?
I've watched Twilight Zone. My favorite is obviously the pig nose episode because I feel that way all the time.
You mean the Eye of the Beholder?
Yes.
You mean where she's getting the... like
the one where like the one beautiful... The one who doesn't have a pig nose, everyone's like, this ugly wench.
Yeah. The whole time. It's so beautifully shot, too.
So gorgeous. I've thought about it a lot during the last 3 months when I look around at America and I'm like, is everyone losing their mind? I think about the Eye of the Beholder episode and like how the... That poor beautiful girl and all the pig nose people.
Well, that, you know, but that one of the reasons why I love that show so much is because he explores so many themes, so many social, sociopolitical themes, so many existential themes, and a lot of them are really still applicable today. But what I love about the show is that whatever episode stands out to you the most is a roadmap to like what your kind of deepest issues are.
I just laid mine right out.
Exactly, because you know, like for me, there's one where a guy. He wakes up in a jail cell every like he wakes up and he's in a jail cell and he's on trial and he basically is just living the same day over and over and over again. No one will listen to him.
Oh,
and it's like
God.
Right near the end, they start to realize like, oh, they're, you know, and he's like, Dennis Weaver. Dennis Weaver plays the guy. And he's like, I go through this every day and you don't listen. And sometimes you play this character and you play this character, but you're all here. This isn't real. And no one listens to him. And that is always my big like, you know, what if you just people, they just attack and they don't give a shit and they won't listen and they've just condemned you and there's nothing you can do and you didn't do it, but it doesn't matter. They don't care. You know,
I know that's a really Jack. Hates this story and he says I should never say it again, but I'm gonna say it anyway, which is that when I was in, he just doesn't like it because it involves the word fart, which is his least favorite word, and I don't love it either, but we were on a field trip at my school to the Holocaust Museum in eighth grade, which I obviously took very seriously, as a, you know, anyone would, but as someone with, you know, Eastern European Jewish ancestors. And we were standing like waiting for our teacher before we left, and someone farted, and it wasn't me. And I was blamed. And I remember, like, someone was like, I can't believe you would fart in the Holocaust Museum. And I, like, was like, I am a scapegoat. But I also remember thinking for the first time, before that, I'd always thought, it doesn't matter what people think about you as long as you know you didn't do it.
Sure.
And in that moment, I was like, no, actually, it doesn't matter that I didn't do it because everybody thinks I did it.
Right.
And so I've always referred to that as the farting in the Holocaust Museum syndrome. And Jack hates it because he's like, I don't ever want to hear you say that word.
Right.
But he understands the essence of it, which is like, and I think part of growing up is realizing like it's actually like knowing your own heart and knowing your own truth is actually the most important thing. And like people are going to create this hologram of you and you can either live in debt to that or you can kind of go like, no, I know who I am and I know what I am. And I think probably everyone vacillates between those two realities.
Well, yeah. And it's all...
Unless you're like Mel Gibson. He's like, I know who I am. I'm fine.
Someone made a joke on At Midnight the other night that made me laugh so hard where it had somebody with Mel Gibson and her answer was, so I guess we're just fine with him now?
It's like,
it was
so weird.
It's so funny.
I can't stop it's being so weirded out by it. Like, I keep seeing him places and I'm like, are we really just gonna... And especially when you've like when every single day I get tweets at me about like, you know, like a dumb random thing I said in an article and I'm like, guys, Mel Gibson's at the Golden Globes. Look over there.
But what is the thing, is it?
I know.
If you're
he's
okay with it.
He's just casually sitting with Vince Vaughn and Andrew Garfield having a great time. But
I think it's all – a lot of it's self-esteem issues, you know? Like if you – and certainly things that that I feel like I still try to deal with is because you're always a – I think you're always in your head. You're always like a 13-year-old version of yourself.
100%.
And, you know, it's the same thing. Not popular kid. Very few friends. No internet at the time to really kind of bond with other people.
You would have been so good at the internet as a kid, too.
I kind of wonder if I would have become a troll.
That's interesting.
Because as a rebellion to... Just as a rabble-rouser, basically, you know? Like, just as a rabble-rouser to go fuck with people anonymously online... In a comedy way, like not in a serious like hate speech way, but in sort of like a, you know, pretending to like the skunk thing, like pretending to be dumb about things just to get people to go, why are you so, you know?
Also, no one is meaner online than teenagers. Like, whenever I get a tweet, I mean, I don't look at my own Twitter anymore, but whenever I would get a tweet that was, like, truly vicious, I would look and it would be, like, an adorable 17-year-old. And I realized, like, teenagers are so well-versed in the language of cruelty, both from what they watch and from how they interact with each other, that, like, no one can knock you off your base like a pissed off smart 17-year-old.
No, because a lot of them, not all, but certainly a lot of them have yet to really experience like what emotional repercussions are.
Yeah.
So they don't like I think you really do mature into empathy.
Totally.
Some people just have it, but I think some people have to mature into empathy.
Plus, celebrities are fake people to them, and why wouldn't they be?
Exactly.
So it's like they're maturing into empathy and they're talking to what they believe to be just like action, very highly evolved action figures.
Yeah.
So I know I spent a lot of time in chat rooms enraged about things as a teenager.
Well, I remember being so kind of socially ostracized to the extent that I think if I'd had an outlet like an internet, I probably would have, you know, just fucked with people.
Yeah.
But instead, I tried to socialize and I tried to understand and I would move and get a new group of people and it was trial and error.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, thankfully, I went in the direction of, oh, rather than attacking other people to feel superior, I want to try to nurture people to feel more comfortable with themselves.
Which you're doing so good at.
I'm trying.
My friend Amelie Silverstein, shout out to Amelie. We used to go on chat rooms and pretend we were like Adelia's model, like a model for the Adelia's catalog,
yeah,
and be like, tell guys like, my name's Diana, I'm 5'10", I have brown. And a big thing for us was getting guys to tell us what brand their jeans were. Like, look at your tag. What brand of jeans are you wearing? Like, I don't even know what we thought we were doing, but we would like get a guy. He'd be like, I can't see. And we'd be like, take off your pants and look at the tag. And we'd be like, we've just won big time.
You totally got him.
And I remember once a guy asked if we wanted to cyber, and we thought it was so funny. We were like, you're smelling my hair. You're touching my cheek. Like, we like kept it really PG. And it was like kind of a highly evolved bit that we were doing. Amelie was like my true like seventh grade soulmate. She wanted to be a comedian and she was the funniest. I think she might be a lawyer now, but she was like, she had like the sense of humor of like a 57-year-old, really smart 57-year-old woman. Like, it was like having like Fran Lebowitz as your best friend, only seventh grade style, and we got up into some trouble in chat rooms.
That's great. Yeah, I think for me, I ultimately arrived at a place where I feel bad fucking with people. Like, I hate pranks.
I hate pranks.
Even though, you know, like, I love what Billy Eichner does, but I get stressed about it because I could never run up to people on the street.
When I did it with him, I was, like, having a panic attack.
Yeah.
I don't like...
I'm so sorry. Please, I don't mean to fuck with you.
No, I don't like fucking with anyone. And even, like, I'm bad at teasing. Like, yesterday
really
I sent my friend, like, a teasing video on, like, WhatsApp. And then, like, 20 minutes later, I was like, was that too mean? And he was like, no, I just didn't watch it yet, you psycho. Like, I made fun of him and then I couldn't handle having made fun of him. Jack is great because he does really, like, loving pranks. Like, he does pranks, but they don't hurt anybody. Like, he went in and filled his bandmates' fitted sheet with lemons.
That doesn't hurt anybody.
No. Or like, he's got some other pranks he's working on now that are like ornate, but like will never injure anyone. They'll only just like make them laugh when they figure it out.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel like so many pranks are designed to humiliate and I don't do well with that.
Yeah, I don't enjoy that either, because then I just feel bad, because I just always put myself in the position of the person being pranked. And I'm like, oh, this doesn't feel good at all. You caught me off guard. Yeah, good for you. I've been humiliated.
My dad like had a friend from high school who joined a cult and changed his name to Vessel. And I remember my dad came home from hernia surgery and he was like in bed really out of it. And I thought it'd be really funny to go in and be like, someone named Vessel's on the phone for you. And my dad looked like he was going to, like, die. And I realized, I was like, oh, that wasn't fun at all. And then I was like, prank. And my dad was like, you suck. Like, he's just like, that wasn't funny. It scared me. And I'm on pain medication. Like, why did you do that? And I was like, great point.
Yeah, yeah. I'm always going to side with, oh, you damn kids. I'm always going to side with that person. Like, get off his lawn. Come on.
Too.
He's just an old guy. Give him a break.
Give him a break.
You used the Delia's catalog, and you reminded me that when I was 30, I was still in the height of, like, living in this booze cocoon. I was living in Westwood, and where I was far too old to live, because that's where UCLA, that's where I went to college. I moved back there.
And still probably you felt very cool.
I felt I'm so cool. And well, actually, I knew at the time, like, I'm too old to be living here, but I don't know where else to go.
Yeah.
And I didn't know where else to go.
My parents live in Williamsburg. They feel you.
They totally understand. So I was there. And I remember when I first moved into this apartment, the Delia's catalog came and I got it with the rest of my mail and I saw it and I was like, I don't know if I'm allowed to even have this.
It could be illegal.
And then it showed up again. And I remember almost legit getting in a fight with the post. I'm like, because clearly like the previous tenant.
Like, this is not mine.
I go, you can't be delivering this to me. This looks really, I was living alone.
Really
I'm
bad.
30. It's bad enough that I'm the oldest person in this building. You can't be giving me a teen girl catalog.
I know. And it was like the coolest one. Like, if you got Delia's, you were it. And I remember my mom, she was wise. Like, the stuff was crap. So she would only let me get things that were, like, on deep sale. Like, they would send, like, their, like, Delia's clearance catalog. And once a year, it was when you still had to order on the phone, I would circle all of the things I wanted and then do the order, which I was so proud of. And then my mom would get on to give her credit card number.
Yeah.
And it was, like, to me, the greatest day of the year. And I was obsessed. Delia's also sold, like, inflatable furniture and, like, scented candles. And my mom, like, would give, like a $10 allowance for, like, crap things.
Right.
She'd be, like, things that are going to break within a week. But what was, like, Delia's had a lot of, like I remember I had, like, a glow-in-the-dark Betty Boop shirt that I wore to, like, all my camp socials.
It sounds like they're, like, what if you ripped off the facade of Urban Outfitters and it was just a Delia's underneath? Because it sounds like
it was. That's what it was. And they also, sometimes your Delia's would come with, like, a mixtape of, like, hip female artists at the time. Like, it would be, like people who we haven't ever heard from again. But, like, I remember being like, yeah, just wearing Medelia's, listen to Medelia's CD, because it was like and I remember really ornately telling my therapist, because I was switching schools for seventh grade, showing her the things that I thought I might get in Delia's to wear for the first day of school, and, like, even feeling that she felt a little sad for me. And I remember I settled on a shirt that was by a brand called Bug Girl, and the, like, logo was, like, a girl who was a bug. And I was like,
oh, because that's why they called her Bug Girl.
That's why they called her Bug Girl. And I wore, like, that with I had a denim jacket, and I was really into, like, going to, like, whatever, like, Spencer's Gifts and getting, like, sassy pins.
Yeah.
So I had one that said, "Who lit the fuse on your tampon?" And I had one that said, "You go, girl, and just keep on going until you're gone." And I was like, I am funny. I am stylish. Who lit the fuse on your tampon's a real roughie. And this was like, I wouldn't get my period for like another 3 years, Chris. This was just me being like, yeah, I'm a... My favorite comedian at the time was Lisa Lampanelli.
Got it.
And I was working a very specific angle.
That was was your comedy at that time kind of like quick and jabby?
It was quick and jabby and like really, like I would try to make like, again, like, I'm too worried about other people's feelings to make the kinds of jokes that I was making.
Sure.
So it would be like my mom would come out and I'd be like, "Nice boots, mom. What hooker gave you those?" Like, it was just like so rude.
It's like morning show comedy.
Yeah. And my mom would be like, I remember my mom literally being like, "You're not funny."
Right.
I was just trying things. And then when I was 14, I went to stand-up comedy school at the Stand-Up Institute of America, which is a room in Times Square where I went to comedy school with all adults in a 10-week program my parents bought me for Christmas. And I remember, like, then I realized that I wasn't as interested. And he was like, "Some people are into audience, like, comedy, engaging the audience, doing..." And I was like, I realized I wasn't, like, a sassy, mean girl. I realized my comedy had to be self-directed cruelty.
I'm always going to be my own heckler, and I'm always going to attack that heckler.
Yes, exactly.
But I think it's, you know, I'm curious what your experience is like being trying to balance the parts of your personality that are, you know, the strong comedy voice,
yeah,
and then also social activism. Because sometimes people can only categorize someone as one thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if they see you as social activist but you're in comedy mode and they go, "I can't believe you just said that." Oh, well, you know, yeah, people are a lot of different things, you know.
Yeah.
So they're not just one thing.
Totally. And I'm also not good, like, I'm not good at making like hilarious topical jokes. Like, I'm not like the person who's going to come at you with like a great like you know, Flynn stepping down Zinger. Like, right. I'm pretty earnest when it comes to politics. And I'm also pretty earnest, like, at the end of the day, I'm pretty earnest. And so it can be confusing because, like, when I post something about Planned Parenthood, I'm not full of incredible sass about it. I'm like, this is what I believe is best for the world, and this is, I'm going to share with you my, like, most intimate experiences. And then I'm most comfortable with comedy as, like, a tool for exploring my own neuroses rather mm-hmm. than, and which, and I don't have a lot, I don't have, I wish that I was, like, able to, like, formulate, you know, like, a hilarious and incisive Ivanka Trump tweet, but all I can really say is, like, this situation makes me sad. Like, that's all I've got. And so I'm always trying to balance it, and I'm always trying to make sure that my, like, Twitter doesn't become, like, a punishing parade of requests for funds or an account of what I'm eating. And stepping back from social media and not I don't tweet. I used to tweet all the time and say lots of sassy things, and now I mostly just share if I've written something or if I'm doing an event, because I realized, like, the medium was starting to feel, like, inauthentic and punishing to me.
Well, it's hard. So, you know, it's difficult. Social media is not – it's not really a place for conversation. It's really a place for shouting, kind of.
Yeah.
And so just because the nature of – it's short bursts of words.
Yeah.
And the ones that are going to rise to the top are the most, emotional in some way. Yeah. And so it's usually a – you know, it's like this gap between a synapse firing in someone's brain and social media is shortening to the extent that it's so much emotional outbursting and not enough like, hey, let's all talk and figure out, you know, can we understand each other or can we, I don't agree with you, but is there a way that we can either at least come away civilly or at least be able to somewhat understand where the other person is coming from?
Yeah.
Because just shouting at each other all the time isn't really going to fix anything. And it's just going to make everyone defensive. Yeah. So
my boyfriend does this thing. Jack does this thing, which I really like, which is like he'll ask a question on his social media. He'll be like, genuine question, not judging anyone. For those who follow me who voted for Trump, how are you feeling about X right now? Mm-hmm. And he says it is really educational for him because like he was surprised to learn that he had fans who had voted for Trump for various reasons and now felt scared or concerned or were able to give him insight into why. And like bringing a non-judgmental question to Twitter was like almost people were almost like, are you serious? You're asking
You're fucking with us. Are you fucking with us?
You must be doing a prank. But he said it felt really good to have those interactions. And there's a sort of generosity of spirit there that I would like to be able to tap into. Like, I tend to be in our – he's very – like, he's been an activist for as long as he's been a public person and always really focused his energy mostly on LGBTQ issues and sort of being an ally to those communities. And he's taught me a lot about how to, like, be an activist from a place of positivity and not a place of anger because
sure.
It's so easy to go in just, like – being like, this world is fucked.
Yeah.
And it is.
And fuck you.
And fuck you. And it is. But, like, we can't ever hope to have anyone join our team if we're not, like, coming from a place of love and understanding. Like,
I agree.
A huge goal of mine for this year is to really understand, like, okay, so 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump. Why? And what are they scared of? And what have they internalized that's made them think that this is the president they deserve? And how can we have a cogent conversation with each other? And can we?
Well, I really believe that, you know, not everyone who thinks the opposite of me is the monster is a monster. And not everyone who agrees with things that I believe is always an awesome person, you know? And
a lot of the most vitriolic attention I've gotten is from people who I ostensibly share politics with but who don't like the way I'm going about it or what my voice or my vibe or – and something I realized this year that was really important to me was to get – you know, I grew up in New York and there's a lot of like sort of like that's, you know, the home of like, you know, sassy literary gatherings and Gawker and Jezebel. And I realized I was like, I really, really want to remove myself from – what I feel are like toxic communities that I think I always thought as a young person it was my job to impress. And now I'm like, oh, it's totally okay to just have like disparate sets of friends, raise poodles and and dream your dreams and not be constantly trying to convert the snarks of the world.
So as we're kind of winding this down, this is the when is the final season premiere?
So we premiered this past week.
This past week.
We premiered on February 12th. I was not even watching. I was just lying in bed reading a book, knowing it was happening. And I've long since given up, like, waiting for reactions on Twitter or anything. Sure. That's a toxic proposition if ever there was one. But yeah, we're gonna be airing for the next 9 weeks, and then we have a big finale show that we put together after our finale. That's sort of like a look back on all the seasons, which makes me cry, but I am me. So
well, and you, I mean, I honestly feel like you're not made of wood. I mean, this was a significant chunk of your life, and you threw a significant. Not just of yourself into it, but also like it's time and energy and like, and you're fostering this, you know, like a work thing is a life. It's like a life. You're bringing this thing to life.
There's a lot of mourning that I wasn't expecting, especially because we chose to end the show. It's not like we got canceled. We are so lucky. We made the choice. Like, this is the time. These characters have done what they needed to do, and we've done what we needed to do with them. But like, that was my family and my friends, and I haven't. There hasn't been a birthday for the last 6 years that I haven't celebrated with my, you know, from 24 to 30. All my birthdays were surrounded by this super loving group of people who all had this common goal of making this work. And you know, now I'm working on a book, and I sort of sit at my desk and go like, "Who am I, and why am I so alone?" but I'm really proud of the final season, and so especially proud of the other girls on the show and of Jenny and Judd who made it with me. And like, I just feel like all I want is just for them to feel like they're the amazing thing that they've done is getting the attention it deserves.
I think they do, and I think they see that the impact the show had. And I've, you know, I know Judd, not really well, but I know him, and he's always been
really into you.
I love that guy. And Allison Williams is fucking awesome.
Isn't she
I don't know her well. We're kind of acquaintance. We email every once in a while and say, hey, how's it going?
She's the best.
She's awesome.
Well, it's so funny because people just see Allison, and like, she has that look where it's like you could literally throw a bucket of dirt on her and she would still look like she was like on the cover of a Banana Republic catalog. Like, she's so clean and beautiful and tidy. You don't realize she's like the funniest, smartest, most like constantly educating herself, constantly pushing herself, asking herself the big questions, an amazing friend. I mean, Allison is a golden treasure.
And really great. I saw Jordan Peele's movie, and she's great in it.
She was so picky. Like, Allison wants to do things that like create conversation and social change, and she's not fucking around about that.
She's really great.
I'm so excited. She told me, I mean, this is so Allison. She like wouldn't tell me what happened in the end. She's like that obsessed. She's like, I'm not gonna give you spoilers. And I was like, okay. But she's true. Like, Allison is someone where if you ask her to keep a secret, she's not gonna half keep it. She's gonna
good.
Keep it.
Good. Well, I'm so glad we were finally able to get you on. I know it's something that we've But my schedule sucks. And also when
we've tried to do it and probably I also feel like I like always have a cold. I feel like I'm always like, I wish I could. I had it like literally one time someone said to me, like, I came to a women in TV event and they were like, this is the third time you've showed up late talking about having a stomach ache. And I was like, I always have a stomach ache. I don't know what to say. Like, all my, I'm like never out drinking. I'm never out being like a wild child. I just am like, just out having a poor immune system.
Yeah. Oh, that's, I'm so sorry that you, but do you feel like you're managing it, or do you feel like, this is just how it is?
I feel half the time like my body's eating me alive, but I feel like I have such a lucky life. It doesn't matter.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I spend a lot of time very happy in bed. Sick.
Well, listen, as long as you're...
Like, that's just the truth of it. But I love it, and I love... And if it's good if you like to read.
Yeah. Hey, I want to ask you one question. Yeah. When you... just because of the nature of what your podcast is and what you talk about, and is it... I hope this doesn't come off wrong.
Nothing.
But if a guy came up to you and he's like, hey, I listen to your podcast, I totally get it. Do you see where I'm going with this? Like, do you sort of feel like, well, you can't fully get it if you're a dude? Like,
I feel like I'd be pretty touched if a guy was like, I love your podcast. I mean, it would be one thing if he was like, listen to that. Like, it's interesting because there's a fine line. I love when men try to educate themselves about feminism. Like, what a cool turn on. I don't like when men try to be like, here's how feminism should move forward. And there's an increasing thing of like guys who are like, I identify as a feminist, and here are 5 steps I think the movement needs to take. And it's like, we all need to learn how to like sit back and allow, like, you know, whatever group is taking the mic at that moment to express their, just like I need to sit back and like listen to my, you know, trans sisters or sisters of color. Like I don't love being told, like, I don't love, like, I remember a guy once said to me, like, sometimes I just feel like there's no place for me in the feminist movement. And I was like, that's probably because there kind of isn't right now. And like, dudes have had the chance to like dominate the dialogue for a long time. So there's certain areas, but like when a guy says he listens to the podcast and feels like he learns from it, or even when he says, I watched the show and it makes me feel like I understand my girlfriend or my sister better, like, that to me is so touching.
That's different than the supposition of,
yeah,
hey, I totally get it, and here's what we're going to do. Like, yeah. Well, I don't even
remember. Like, I loved seeing guys at the Women's March, but I was like, there's a fine line between, like, being at the Women's March to support and being at the Women's March because you, like, believe that you have the answers that are going to take us. Like, I think it's really becoming clear that, like, women have never benefited from men, even well-meaning men, attempting to make decisions about their bodies and their futures.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that we don't need – everyone needs allies. Like, we all need to be each other's allies in all of the big fights that are coming up.
Yeah. Well,
I'm your ally, Chris.
I am your ally as well. And this was so nice that you came.
It was such an honor. And I realized, I was like, I wore my pajamas, but that's because we're on a podcast.
Yeah, honestly, like, seriously,
You look cool. You look like you've got cool, like, patches and stuff. I'm literally wearing my dead grandma's fleece.
My dad was too tall. I can't wear any of his clothes.
That's so – oh, my God. You know, how tall was your dad?
My dad was 6'1". I'm like 5'10"-ish. My mom was like – my mom will tell you she's 5 feet tall. She's like 4'11".
That's so cute.
And so my parents – and so I just kind of got – you know.
Yeah. Entire family is 5'10". My sister is 6 feet tall. My mom is 5'10". My dad told me he was 5'10". I think he's more like 5'9" now that I like have an actual – 5'10", 5'11"
boyfriend.
People
do shrink as they get older, though.
That's true. And then so. I'm like bringing up the Jack always calls me the postman's baby because I'm like 5'3" and 30 pounds heavier than everybody else, and just like bringing up the rear.
Well, I just to let you know, like, I'm wearing I'm very much supporting this. These pants have
your jeans have a drawstring.
The jeans have a drawstring. So just before you think that I am, I'm just letting you know like how much comfort I am seeking. My fucking jeans have
a drawstring. That is amazing.
And they're super soft. Like, they're almost kind of pajama material.
I just had to throw away a pair of jeans that had, like, a stretchy waistband because I was like, I can't give up this soon in life. Like, they were jeans with, like, an elastic waistband that I got in Japan. Here's an amazing detail. In Japan, I can only shop at plus-size stores.
What?
Well, in Japan, like, they don't make jeans over, like, a size, like, 24 waistline. So there's an amazing store for, like, curvy women in Japan called Punyus, which means chubby in Japanese. And I got and this really cool girl named Naomi Watanabe.
It has the word poon in it.
I know. And she started Punyus, and it's, like, all of it fits me perfectly. And in Japan, it's literally considered to be, like, a line for obesity.
Oh my God.
And that's where my stretchy waist jeans came from. And I was like, as much as I love Punyus, like, I can't be wearing a jean with an elastic waistband. But I do continue to wear my Punyus turtlenecks and my Punyus hair clips.
That is so interesting.
I didn't get it. I went into an area and I was like, these clothes are awesome and they fit me. Why is nobody else in this section? And then I like looked around and I was like, because I'm in a Japanese shopping mall and everybody weighs 11 and a half pounds and I'm alone in Punyus.
I don't think there's anything wrong with and maybe this is just me getting older. I don't think there's anything wrong with comfort. There is nothing wrong with comfort.
Let's send that out into the masses because I feel like a lot of people are really punishing themselves right now.
Yeah, and that might be a little contradictory to what I said earlier about how we're addicted to I think we're there's nothing wrong with comfort, but you don't want to seek being comfortable at the cost of growth. How about that?
That's so beautifully said. There's nothing wrong with taking care of yourself every single day in special small ways, but you have to be striving towards a better tomorrow.
Yes, and sometimes that means being uncomfortable, and sometimes, you know, maybe you've already gone through it. You might go through a period of a while where you have to mourn that not just the show being done, but also like you're the 20s and moving on. But the good news is, and I can tell you from having passed the 40 mark, is that when you get past it, you're like, oh, okay, I don't feel like a dumb shit. I feel a lot better. I was so worried about this other stuff before, and I got past it, and it's okay.
Every woman is like, every woman I know seems to think that, like, each decade of their life was radder than the last. Like, everyone loves being, every evolved woman I know loves being the age that she is. Well, no one's like,
when you get older, you get more wisdom and awareness. You're not aware when you're like 19 because you just, it's just all about like,
I can't believe what an idiot I was when I was 19.
What can I put in my body? You know, like what substances or what, you know, like
for
what?
For me, it was a lot of pizza.
And you don't really think about anything or consequences. When you start to get older, you just feel like you have a little more control over the game, like a little more.
Totally.
Like, okay, if I do this, this will happen. And I avoid these things and I will not feel that pain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to take, I found this conversation very therapeutic. And I'm going to take it with us.
Please do. Please take it with you and take it with you if you're listening right now and enjoy your burrito.
We love you. Thank you for having me. Thanks. Did you say enjoy your burrito?
That's how we end the podcast.
I forgot that. It's so great.
Yeah.
I'm going to enjoy the green tea Kit Kat.
Enjoy your green tea Kit Kat.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.